Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is my trusty co-host, Mr. Spencer Nick Castle Williams.
Whatever, I don't mind being the sheep.
We have a great show in store as we are not only celebrating my birthday! But we are also being joined by the illustrious part-timer slash intern slash stenographer slash coffee bringer who brings no coffee slash I need to be nicer to, but I won't. Ensign Amy.
I'm still an ensign. I'm appreciative of this.
Yes. Death Day is coming.
Oh, my.
That sounded like a threat. I'd like to work on that, please.
Sorry, there's no HR here. We're excited to have Amy on the show as we are going to be talking about one of the traditional films that we usually watch every year, and the actual franchise, quote unquote, ends here as we talk about Halloween Ends. So stick around as we dive into that. But before we do, Spencer, give them the opening credits.
Tune in each and every Wednesday morning on all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. We are everywhere. Wherever you are looking for us, we are there. We are on the internet at our website at filmlosophers.com. There we have over 300 episodes, allegedly, with everything from anime to action to romance to comedy to conversations about the industry. If you're looking for it, we got it. Check us out, filmlosophers.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, whether if it's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart. You can tune in to wherever your heart's desire is. Find us there. Give us a subscribe. Listen in. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Drop us a line on those pages. Let us know how we're doing. I mean, and if you think we're worth a 5-star review, give us a 5-star. We've earned it.
We have.
Yes, we have. We have everything there as well, and our social tags will be at the end. Sorry, I kind of lost it there. It's true. We are celebrating a birthday, and it is my birthday.
Yay!
Every year we try to see a movie that really pushes the whole idea of, number one, Halloween and horror, and number two, Amy to a very uncomfortable place.
Which is many places, to be very honest.
And so usually when that happens, we try to pick something that can be a tradition, number one, and number two, that can be carried every year. And unfortunately, this will be the last year for this tradition unless, I mean, let's just be honest, they're going to make another one. It's just not going to be the same. But supposedly this is the end of this franchise, or it's the end of the what did you call it, Amy, the other day?
The end of the Strode saga.
The end of the Strode saga, taken straight out of Star Wars. this has been one of those things where I've wanted to do something like this for a long time, and when the first film dropped, I immediately said, okay, I want to do a watch party. I want us all to see the movie. We're gonna watch it and then we'll review it, and you have to watch it because it's my birthday. And
that was the caveat. Like,
it was.
That was the caveat. And that started the first, because they've all come out on October 14th for the last 3 years.
I believe so. I'm not too sure the release date for all of them, but I know this last one did.
The last two, I can remember that they were on the 14th.
Mm. Well, yeah, because it coincided with my birthday. My birthday, October 15th. So we all got a chance to see all three of these movies together, and we all got a chance to talk about them afterwards on the show. And so this is kind of one of those things that I look forward to each year when my birthday comes around. There's not a lot of things I can tie to my birthday cinematically. I'm not a big person of like, oh, let's watch this movie just for the sake that it has to do with it. Like, I wanted something that kind of emphasizes the idea of, number one, Halloween, one of my favorite holidays. Number two, something that is released near or around my birthday, which this film was. And something, like I said, that will push Amy to her very edges of comfort. And let me just say, that is probably the biggest joy I have as part of this show, is pushing Amy to her edges, which, mind you, she's been a good sport. She's seen the last other two, including this one. And I'm going to have to think of, Spence, I'm going to have to think of something bigger next year, because this franchise is essentially over.
I mean, you better hope someone puts out like a movie, like a new one, new something next year.
If not Halloween, something like something bombastic. Let's make her sit through like, Hellraiser, and we'll do Hellraiser.
Oh, I've never seen that one.
It is a good one. Amy's eyes are the size of...
It's just the title. Don't worry about it.
No, it's not. I wikied that. I wikied the books. I know what that is, because guess what? My guys at the Capeless Crusaders were like, we're going to do four Nights of Frights. And the first movie that they recommended was Hellraiser. And I was like, no, no. And then, of course...
Well, for the fact that... So your guys, your podcast, team, yeah. Which consisted of Anthony Esteves and Tom...
From Nerd On.
Nerd On TV down in LA, they were wanting to do something unique. They wanted you to also step outside your lane and what you're used to. So they initially said Hellraiser, and then it shifted to an even better movie, which was Event Horizon.
And I'm only partially through that. And that
she's only about like less than two quarters in through it. Like she's like 30-40%.
I was excited initially because I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. Like, it was neat. The premise is good. And then It's coming, and I don't like it.
It was, yeah, because I was
texting you and yelling in all caps, and it's literally...
Well, she goes, I'm going to put on Event Horizon while I'm working, because she works from home at times.
Oh, no, don't do that.
And she goes, I'm going to watch it while I'm at home. Sarah's, you know, I got my kids with me. My oldest is with me. We're both going to watch. I'm like, I don't know if you want your oldest with you there.
That was the first trigger.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay, then I'll watch it by myself. So I put it on my phone. So I'm typing, I'm doing my work, and it's on the phone. It's really small. And then I was like, oh, okay, this is like, premise is good. And then I was like, oh no. Oh no. And then I sent a very loud exclaiming text that says, is this a movie about hell in space on a spaceship? And I started freaking out, and I was like, okay, I'm going to watch it later. I haven't finished it. Don't tell anybody.
Mind you, that was last week.
Yeah.
Event Horizon is actually one of the first horror movies I remember seeing.
Because it's sci-fi horror, essentially. It's like, it's true to the name sci-fi horror. Not along the lines of like Aliens is a sci-fi thriller. You have more of the idea of things that are in space. Aliens, things that are going to kill you, like not breathing. Stuff like that. This is bringing like supernatural situations into the fray and having people just go nuts and lose their marbles and just destroy each other. Plus, it's an awesome opportunity to see Sam Neill really lose his marbles.
No, that was cool.
I believe she didn't even get to that point. I think the last thing she texted me, she said...
I'm like, he's possessed. He has to... I'm like, I can't watch him possessed. And he has his natural accent, which I'm like, no, I need him normal, Sam. Let him be normal and friendly.
So we'll have to figure out something. If you're listening to this and you have any ideas... Please let us know. I'm all for suggestions or new franchises to kind of delve into for a new Halloween / birthday tradition. Because to be honest, I like keeping that going because it's the one guarantee that I have that Amy is going to see a horror movie ever in the history of ever of all year. So, yeah, let me know. In fact, if you have some like really, really spooky, you know, crazy ones, let me know. I'm not going to do any like... body horror type ones like Human Centipede or whatever.
Thank God.
Yeah, this was a great opportunity. We got a chance to see it all together, and we got a chance to because we were all at my party, and we were watching it on the projector and everything. And I'm actually really stoked to talk about this. And mind you, it has nothing to do with the discomfort of Amy, maybe slightly, but still, let's jump.
I like that it's like the discomfort, and you might be slightly shocked at what I have to say about this movie.
Well, I'm pretty sure it's probably going to be on par with everybody else. So here we go, as we dive into the last film of the sequel trilogy, Halloween Ends. This has been a movie that has been talked about and been, you know, projected to be one of the most antithesis type movies of this franchise as a whole. So we all got a chance to see it, like I said. And before we get into our review, Spencer, give us the synopsis goodness.
4 years after the events of last year's Halloween Kills, Laurie is living with her granddaughter, Allison, and is finishing writing her memoir. Michael Myers hasn't been seen since. Laurie, after allowing the specter of Michael to determine and drive her reality for decades, has decided to liberate herself from fear and rage and embrace life. But when a young man, Corey Cunningham, is accused of killing a boy he was babysitting, it ignites a cascade of violence and terror that will force Laurie to confront the evil she can't control once and for all.
Directed by David Gordon Green, the film stars, obviously, the Scream Queen herself, Jamie Lee Curtis. Oh, that was a hiccup. Andy Matichak, Rohan Campbell, Will Patton, Kyle Richards, and James Jude Courtney, and Marks Curtis and Nick Castle's final appearances in the series. A couple key pieces of the information about the film. Halloween Ends actually uses the blue font used in Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, for its opening credits. This movie, Halloween Ends, is actually released 40 years after Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. Another key piece of information, Nick Castle has a non-Michael Myers cameo for the first time in this trilogy as a partygoer who flashes his costume at Corey and says, "See anything you like?" Which is actually a nod to the iconic line said by Linda in the first Halloween back in 1978. And last piece of information, producer Jason Blum reiterated that while it would not be the final film in the franchise, it will be the last Halloween movie under Blumhouse, with the rights of the film series reverting to producer Malik Akkad following the release of Halloween Ends. So it's going to be interesting whether or not if they decide to honor what is done with this trilogy and kind of go its own way, or if they do another reboot. I don't know. You know, that's always something that's on the horizon. So as we stated, this is going to be a review of the film, but it'll also be a spoiler review. So if you haven't seen the movie, you should probably pause this here, check out the film, watch it, and then come back and hear our thoughts. We'll still be here. We'll wait for you, okay? Just take your time, and when you come back to us, we'll be ready, okay?
Mm-hmm. Bring snacks.
Exactly.
Please bring snacks.
So, in as far as the movie is concerned, one of the first things that, obviously, when you think about Halloween, you think of Michael Myers. You think of the Shape. You think of the boogeyman. You think of the individual that has embodied this entity, this evil personified, in every single film, whether if it's in the original films, whether if it's in the reboot films, or even the subsequent follow-up sequels to the first film, during the 90s and early 2000s, you always think about that. So my thought, my first question to you guys is, what are your thoughts about the idea of the boogeyman or the Shape, in terms of the juxtaposition as it being the antagonist in this film, or the force of evil as it is? Like, what are your thoughts on that whole role? Because, like, for me, when you think about horror movies, you usually think, okay, there is a centric evil character. There is an individual. There is a group of individuals. We talked about vampires a couple weeks ago. Like, you think when you think about the Lost Boys, you think about, you know, those guys, you know, David and all them that are just eating people and doing stuff. And they're the antagonist. There's a central focus here. Much like Freddy Krueger in Nightmare on Elm Street, not much like the Friday the 13th follow-ups with Jason Voorhees, or even Child's Play with Chucky. You have a centrical focus on a specific character or group of characters. This has always been, Halloween has always been in the mindset that Michael Myers is just the body. The whole idea of the antagonist in this film is the evil that embodies Michael Myers. That's kind of what the Dr. Loomis talks about in the first film, as well as throughout other films. And it gets a little cloudy with the other movies, but like just within this order, if you will, from, you know, number one to Halloween back in 2018, I believe, mm-hmm. and then 2019, and then you had this one in 2022. 2019, 2020. 2020, 2021, and 2022, but they take place in the years prior because it's obviously when they're filming. So my question is, like, what do you guys think about the idea of the movie being more focused on this embodying entity? Because it almost kind of seems like with Regan from The Exorcist, they're not fighting Regan, they're fighting the spirit within Regan, mm-hmm. the demonic spirit. You know, you have situations like that. I mean, and even in more light humor, you're looking at things like Ghostbusters and the first Ghostbusters, how Sigourney Weaver's character and Rick Moranis' character are the gatekeeper and the keymaster. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not evil per se, but they're the spirit embodying them is as they work for Zool. You know, so what are your thoughts on that as a driving force for these types of movies? Amy, start with you. Since you look like you might have something to say.
Oh, thanks. I always find it interesting because, well, to start off for me, if nobody's listened to the other Halloween episodes, I've only seen the very first, the original Halloween, and then the 2018, the 2020 or 2021, and then this one. So I'm pretty much like, I'm not going to say I'm a purist, but I have the most Lori focused, like, kind of picture or view of this franchise. So when we start talking about the shape, it's hard for me to really see it other than the person in the mask, mm-hmm. The Inside Out Shatner mask. I'm sorry. Because that's how evil.
It's not Inside Out. It's just painted white.
I thought it was Inside Out.
No, I also thought that.
No, so the mask. So what they did was in the first film, they didn't have the funds, so they took a William Shatner Star Trek mask. Mm-hmm. They painted it white. They teased out the hair, and that's what he's wearing.
Oh,
it's not.
Because if you turn it inside out,
you're just gonna have the hair
be like little plugs, looking like a Cabbage Patch doll with a big knife. So
that's still scary. I mean,
that would be scary.
Like if you shaved off Chucky's hair, that would be.
Oddly enough, in the first episode for the new season of the Chucky series, there is a Chucky doll that is completely bald.
Weird.
So it's interesting.
Okay, so because I have for so long seen the shape as that particular shape, it's more of a, as much as Dr. Loomis and everybody has talked about that, it's the evil within, it's the evil that we're fighting, it's, you know, evil incarnate, and Michael is evil incarnate. It doesn't give space in this franchise that I feel that evil can be really introduced or live in another shape, which we'll come to talk about later on.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's such a big, broad concept. I mean, it's like, it's the, where do you start? Like you tell somebody, I want to eradicate evil. Okay, well, where do you start?
Mm-hmm.
And this franchise has put such a focus on Michael Myers being not only the antagonist, but being the evil when he is no longer there. Is evil either like still present or does the shape change shape? So like it's difficult for me to separate the two cleanly in regards to this franchise. I hope that made sense.
That did. Well, because like that's also my problem because like
yeah.
when you're talking about like the other like franchises you mentioned, like Regan from Exorcist, like there's two very distinct characters there. There's Regan and then the evil inside. While here it's just the evil inside, because like I don't think we really ever hear from Mike. I because we're talking about the 1978 one is how far back you'd have to go, and I can't even remember if he talked in that
he
one.
He doesn't.
He grunts and he doesn't say anything.
He makes noise and he breathes. And the one time that we see him outside of the mask is when he's a little kid.
Yeah.
No, actually, you see him outside of the mask in the first film. Because when Laurie...
Was talking about the 78.
Yeah, in the 78 film.
When he first puts on the mask?
No, so there's a scene where he's at the top of the stairs and he ended up getting stabbed in the eye by the coat hanger.
Oh, that's right.
And somehow he's able, the mask comes off somehow shortly after, and she runs down the stairs in an opportunity that she has, and as she's running down the stairs, he gets up, and you see his face very briefly in the dim light, and he pulls the mask back on. So you do see it in that film, not so much in other follow-up films, I don't believe, nor in any, like, none of the Rob Zombie iterations. So you don't really see his face prior to. He essentially embodies the anonymity, I guess, if you will, of what the mask gives him, which is kind of like what they introduced in the first of the new trilogy, where he isn't so much anything until he puts on the mask, essentially, because then it just helps him embody that evil or something.
Actually, no, that's hitting it exactly on the head. It's like he is nothing until he has that mask on. And, like, it's weird that, like, there is no flip side to this guy. It's just pure evil and murderous intent for no reason.
Yeah. Because you look at it, Michael Myers kind of embodies this unstoppable force that continues to come back, whether if it's by, you know, unique storytelling or, like we saw in the early 2000s movie, cheap tricks and you know, bad story writing in the follow-up films. The one where Laurie ends up running a van into him, decapitating him, causing him to get decapitated, and then the next film you see the last minutes of that film, and he had actually grabbed a security guard, put his clothes on him, including his mask, and put him in that situation, and he's the one who got decapitated, and Michael Myers was still running around. Which is cheap. it's one of those moments where, like, you definitively are in tune with what Kathy Bates is saying when she's talking about those those cereals at the movie theaters. We're like, yeah, he didn't get out of the cock-a-doodle car, you know. So I feel like the idea, you have to be somebody who, number one, really has a plan set out for what he's trying to do, whether if it's John Carpenter or David Gordon Green, to create something so unique as an entity or an individual who just embodies the fullness of evil. And maybe it's not the evil that's like a spirit or anything, but maybe it's just so much the drive that he has when he's doing it, as we'll get into in this film. But either way, like, you, because it would seem boring if you had the same situation, like the worst kind of Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner kind of chase around that you'd see, but with knives and people dying. Mm-hmm. So with everything John Carpenter created with this movie and what we got to see with David Gordon Green doing the follow-up, it was a smart choice to create somebody who appears human at the beginning, who has a sense of humanity, not a sense of humanity. There is a sense of mortality to the individual at the beginning, and then you see kind of like a I know it's a bad comparison, but kind of like an X-Men 3 with the Juggernaut, where he keeps going and he essentially can't be stopped. That's kind of what we get with Michael Myers. Once he gets going, it'll take like an act of God for him to stop, because this man has been shot, stabbed, cut, you know, probably ran over with a Zamboni or something. Like, there's probably a million and one ways that he's, like, been hurt or should have been mortally wounded, and yet he still comes back. And in this case, this movie really was supposed to be kind of the cap to that story. Like, how do you stop somebody who is unstoppable? And it brings back that old adage of, you know, what happens when an unstoppable force hits an immovable object? You know, that immovable object being Laurie Strode. And I think that's kind of what the climax of each of these movies does bring, in that you have somebody who is unstoppable in his killing and in his evil, and you have somebody who, such as like Laurie Strode, who is unbreakable and unwilling to yield to this force and will always meet him where he is at and continues to do so. You know, the genius of this movie is that we don't see Laurie Strode in her prime. She's not somebody who is like, you know, she went to the military, came back, and she's all buff. She's like, what's her name? Linda Hamilton from Terminator 2. Like, she didn't... Sarah Connor. She didn't go and get training from all these people and knows how to... And she's buff, and she's like, she works out. The crazy thing is that Linda Hamilton actually was able to do all those things in the movie. And it's like, oh, wow, that woman went through a lot. But you take, like, from Terminator 2 to Terminator 2, Terminator 1 to Terminator 2, and you have the transition. You take Halloween 1, and you take the next one in this particular series, this chronological order, with the 2020 Halloween, and we get that with Laurie Strode. She has been preparing for Michael to get out. She's been preparing for Michael to come back, and she has booby-trapped the heck out of her house. She knows how to shoot. She knows how to fight. She knows how to use a knife. She knows how to, like, set up explosions and stuff like that around her house. She was prepared. Nevertheless, we have this massive climactic, you know, combat between the two, and it follows through all the way up until this film. So, talking about this movie, I guess the most obvious question is, what were your guys' first impressions as soon as the movie ended? Let's start with Spencer.
And that's really the best way to say that.
That is, he's pulling an Amy answer here. Okay,
I feel like it's a very apt answer for this movie, though.
Okay, Amy.
I mean, you're gonna get a different vowel sound for me, but it was,
The thing about this movie is it starts in a place that I just did not expect. Took turns to places that I was like, why are we here? And then just like ended as like, oh yes, I was expecting this, and that was nice.
Yeah. Anyway. What about, yeah. I mean, I can mirror some of that, because it started in a place where I was like, okay. And then it was going, and I was like, okay. Yeah, yeah. And then you got to, and you're, okay. And then you're like, okay. Okay, Eddie.
I was literally trying to figure out where you were done.
It's literally just different ways to say okay.
You see the movie, that makes loads of sense,
right?
My immediate first impressions were, well, it was a movie. You know, it was definitely something that someone put a lot of time and effort into thinking this is what people wanted to see, which I give them that. You know, there was an effort to create a larger sense of humanity to the characters that have been through so much. They wanted to tell a survivor story, but they also wanted to show that evil does not just reside in one thing, that it is a global thing. It is a thing that is all around us. I felt like the movie did start off with a really big twist, if you will, a really big kind of shocker. And then it took us a little while to get back to that pacing of things happening, because there was a lot of psychological buildup and recognition of people changing and things happening. And it reminded me of, which one was it? There was a Friday the 13th movie.
Never seen any of them, I saw one.
Let me know when you're done.
Nope, okay. Never going
to
be done.
There was a Friday the 13th movie, and I believe it might be Jason Goes to Hell. That's the name of the movie, Jason Goes to Hell. In that movie, in the beginning, I believe Jason has either died or... I believe he's fully gone. Like, he's a crisp, charred remain of a husk. And this this medical examiner is like so engrossed with Jason and how he's just existing or whatever. And I believe he ends up reaching into Jason's chest, grabs his heart, and then bites it. And I believe the medical examiner gets possessed by Jason. And he becomes something of the sort of like Jason, doing all the killing and whatnot. It's interesting. But eventually the other Jason comes back. And there's a really great end credit to that one where at the end, Jason's mask gets knocked off. And Jason dies or whatever and stuff happens and Jason's mask is just laying there and then Freddy's hand comes straight up through the ground, grabs the mask and pulls it down, which lends itself to the whole idea of Freddy versus Jason that eventually came later. I say all that to say I kind of got a glimpse of that in this movie in the effort to try to showcase that his evil can be mimicked but never truly replicated in a source. And it doesn't always bode well for the overall story. Mm. And that kind of goes for this film. So jumping into this movie, let's talk about the story. So in this story, we have Corey Cunningham, who we talked about that big shocker at the beginning of the film, accidentally kills a kid by knocking him over, the third story stairwell straight down to the middle of the foyer and kills him and is essentially ostracized from the neighborhood. He's demonized by everybody. I think we need to talk about Kevin, the mom situation. That's kind of what happened here with him. And he meets Allison, whom at this point, Allison and grandma, AKA Laurie Strode, are living together, trying to have some semblance of a life. Both of Allison's parents are dead. And it's just her and grandma. Most of her friends are dead. And so this whole situation where Allison meets Corey, Allison kind of has a thing for him, kind of a whole, sick project kind of thing where like they take on people who are just bad people who try to make them better, kind of things like that. And Corey just kind of does this whole downhill spiral of wanting to prove that he's not a pushover and he doesn't want to be demonized anymore. Ultimately comes face to face with Michael, realizes that Michael actually saves him for whatever reasons he doesn't know. And long story short, Corey tries to become Michael. Michael is still Michael. Stuff happens and we'll talk about the ending. To a point, would you agree that's kind of the basis of the film?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll stop there.
Well, go ahead.
But I just feel like it shouldn't be. Like, if anything, like, I feel like this movie should be two separate movies. Like, one dealing with Michael and Laurie and, like, the granddaughter there, and, like, they do a thing with Michael, and then, like, the granddaughter's like, okay, we're done with him, I'm leaving. And then Corey and his thing is, like, a next movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that. Like, it would definitely be one of those ones where they would have to make another movie.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I would...
I feel like they're already going to try.
I know.
No, they are. That's not even a question. I do agree with Spencer in the fact that this story, that was, as you stated, Eddie, that was pretty much the story.
Yeah.
And the fact of it is that the focus is so much not on the Strode women for literally the first, 40 minutes mm-hmm. of the movie, that you're like...
Other than, like, the interludes of, like, them reflecting responding to the way the town feels about them or the way they feel about themselves.
Well, and even then, it's not... It feels like it's thrown in there as an afterthought. Like, we're getting voiceovers for Laurie writing her memoir. And so we're seeing that, and we're seeing her try to process mm-hmm. and all of her therapy and how she's been trying to turn a new leaf. And I'm like, okay, after 4 years and you've gone to therapy, you've stopped drinking, and Allison brings it up. She's like, you should have seen my grandmother before the therapy and this and that. And I'm like, people change. That is 100% correct. People change, and survivors can turn over a leaf. But it also felt in that, not but, And it also felt that they were forcing her to be like Sunshine Daisies of her survivor story.
Oh, definitely.
That was difficult for me to swallow, not because Jamie Lee is a bad actress, mm-hmm. but because the way they wrote Laurie left any hint of her caution, her wariness, they put it out as an afterthought. They took away her in the first half of the movie, they took away her survivalist tendencies and made her like she became the parent that's like, you know what you should do today? You should really try and go make friends. Go make friends. Here's cookies, a sweater, and a balloon, and a pin that says, will you be my friend? Go make friends. Like, mm-hmm. that push was so aggressive that it didn't feel remotely close to the powerhouse of a woman that is Laurie Strode, especially over that we've seen for the last two, for Halloween, for the 2018 Halloween, and then Halloween Kills. So it was really difficult for me to find, like, in this story, the continuity that was deserving of an ending for Laurie.
Mm-hmm. Like, what was also hard for me at the beginning of this is, okay, so from, like, the 2018 Halloween, right? Mm-hmm. What this movie has set up is that, like, oh, Laurie was training for, like, 40-ish years, yes. waiting for this guy to break out. And then he breaks out, comes after her, goes missing for 4 years, and she's like, oh, whatever. Like, yeah. that seems, like, just kind of crazy when that's, like, the most dangerous he's ever been to her.
Yeah, and I mean, that was the other thing that I know. The house that she's bought with Allison, there is no alarm system. She doesn't have any additional guns or weapons. Like, she has a small gun in a gun safe in her office, but other than that, there is no hint of a locked door. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about a woman who has been not only traumatized but gaslit for 40 plus years, and now she's like, everything's hunky-dory, a-okay. On top of that, you have the town who is aggressively...
Do not even get me started on those town folk.
The victimize... The blame the victim mentality, yeah. which is so aggressive and is so true to what happens in society today, made mm-hmm. me so mad. And she's mm-hmm. like, oh, it's fine. And I'm like... No, I'm like, not for... I'm like, for Laurie Strode? Oh, heck no, it ain't. So...
Because if I was in that shopping like mall parking lot, I'd be like, mind your own business. You don't know what the heck happened. Get out of here.
Yeah, well, you goaded a mentally ill man to attack you.
How?
I know. How? Yes, just her, right? Between that and then when we're like, the only person, and I can say this, the only person that I felt in the story that kind of balanced Laurie, old Laurie, was Officer Frank.
Will Patton.
He balanced their interlude was just enough. Mm-hmm. It was never a, I don't believe you. You're not being yourself. Like, it felt, their interaction felt natural. It felt like it was always there and it had always been there. And then everything else around it within the story is spiraling. Like, I don't even want to get started in on this granddaughter. Like, oh, somebody pick up the mic. I'm going to take a break. Nope.
The movie has a very interesting steering for what it's trying to show, because you're right. You have somebody who has spent the last 40 years being probably the most outspoken like educator about the evil and the danger of Michael Myers. Mm-hmm. And that's when he was locked up. And now that he's not locked up and he's somewhere, like... we have to keep in mind, none of the part 2 through H2O or Halloween Resurrection, any of those other ones, ever happened.
Not in the story.
So in this story, she doesn't really know of his like repeat comeback kind of mentality, where he just happens to pop up after being, you know, slice through with whatever or something. Like, they're not used to that. Mm-hmm. So that marks that part, like the whole trying to, I guess, process through and get over, or not get over, but process through and get past, you know, the fear of Michael Myers. I can see that that's maybe what they were trying to do, But someone like Laurie Strode, who has been outspoken and very opinionated and very much like, hey, you got a problem with it, you can go sit on it, like kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, she has been like that for the last 40 years. And then now in this space, because she is playing Susie, you know, edgy mom homemaker kind of thing now, it seemed to domesticate the character that we saw in the last two movies.
Mm-hmm. They chopped her off at the knees, to be very honest, from a character standpoint, for me.
True. And we don't get a lot of, like, we get hints of it throughout the whole film, like her ability to sneak around and like spy on people, or her ability to like move out of a house without making a noise, which was pretty cool.
That was really cool. We're all like, oh shoot, yes.
Like that's her as well. But it's not something that is carried out with how she processes, how she logically sees things, how she's like, she's been trusting her instincts for the last 40 years. And now at this point, she has to second guess them because, oddly enough, in kind of contradictory form, it involves her granddaughter, where she's been doing everything she was doing for the last 40 years to protect her family. And that's what she said. She wanted a place to make that way her family could come and be safe from Michael Myers, and she would be able to put away with him once and for all. Mm-hmm. The idea of what Jamie Lee Curtis is in this movie, I can also, from a standpoint of what the actress was capable of doing, like, I don't know if she's capable of doing a lot of those types of stunts anymore, being thrown around, being doing stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, I'm torn for this story because I can see where the director wanted to carry a sense of humanistic reality to it, to the fact that people age, things happen, some things die out, some things are no longer, you know, in this world anymore, some people are no longer in this world. There's a strong possibility the person you've been worried about no longer even considers you anything. Like, to carry that mentality from this film, and to give Laurie Strode an opportunity to be more human, I guess, instead of the mythological, you know, God Slayer that she was in the last films. But at the same time, I can also see from the perspective of this is Laurie Strode. Mm. This is, like we said, she was shooting bullseyes with a gun like not even 3 years later. There should be more of that training, and the better parts of what she's been doing for the last 40 years, that should have been more, you know, upfront in this movie. And it seemed like more of, like I said, the edgy, you know, edgy mom who wants to stay relevant with her daughter, kind of like, you know, oh yeah, you got to show them your, you know, and just flip them off and this is that and kind of thing. And it just, that was, I don't know, there just seemed to be a little bit of an imbalance of what they were wanting her to perform to do, mm-hmm. and what they were wanting her to say and act out as. Mm. So.
I'd also say Michael probably has a similar problem going on with him in this movie, too. Mm-hmm. Because, like, even from the synopsis I read, this is 4 years later. Mm-hmm. He's done nothing in 4 years. Like, that seems so strange to me. Just, like, the way, like, it's been building him up. Like, these last couple of movies, it yeah. seems strange to me that he's like, I'm just going to lay down. Like, maybe, like, recover, okay, I guess, since yeah. we're not super used to him, like, in this new human mode. But, like, I feel like that would have been, like, maybe a couple of months of quiet, and then things kick back off. Mm. Yeah. But it going this long is weird to me. And then also, later on in the movie, when Michael captures Corey... And, like, I'm assuming the movie's trying to be like, oh, he can detect the evil in him, and that's why they're kind of cool or whatever.
Like a kindred spirit or something.
Yeah, but, like, at the same time, I feel like that would be even more of, like, make Michael understand that this kid's a threat to become like him, and he yeah. can cut off him early.
I was thinking about that, because you think predatory animals, and you think, like, mm-hmm. think in a lion pride or any pride of animals where there is an alpha, and then someone comes to challenge the alpha.
Yeah.
Like, you have always in your mind, there is only one alpha.
Right.
So if the alpha's throne, so to speak, is threatened, the alpha takes out the threat. You would expect that in most situations, if it was a more cognizant mindset, like for Michael, like if I knew, if there was an intention with his nonverbal ability, if there was an intention to kind of placate the throne and hand it to Corey to take over, if there was more of a message like that, I think back on, there's a movie that I really, really like. It's called Mr. Brooks. Mm. Mr. Brooks, and oddly enough, stars Kevin Costner and Dane Cook. Surprisingly, it's actually a good movie. Don't give me that look.
Okay.
No, it is. I can actually confirm.
It's got Kevin Costner, Dane Cook, Demi Moore. And essentially, Kevin Costner is this mild-mannered, literal, like, everyman. He's a quiet businessman who is very successful, but happens to have a proclivity to being addicted to killing.
It's and Daniel so, Panabaker. I don't think it's Demi Moore.
Demi Moore is the officer.
Oh, that's
Daniel
right.
Daniel Panabaker is his daughter. Daniel anyway. His daughter.
Sorry.
So and it's he talks about how it's not something he wants to do, but it's something he's addicted to doing. So when he gives into that, he literally has a whole process for it and everything. So at some point, Dane Cook essentially wants him to show him how to do it. And Kevin Costner wants to get out of it because his daughter is now pregnant and he wants to be home and he doesn't want to spend the rest of his life in jail, you know, and never seeing his daughter again, or his granddaughter again. Ultimately, it turns into like this switcheroo at the tail end and you're like, it's a really great switch up. But there was a plan all along.
Mm-hmm.
There was a whole mentality in the vein of what Kevin Costner was going to do. And I feel like if there was more of an intention on recognizing that's what Michael Myers was doing, he was essentially raising somebody to take his place, then hey, more to it. That's great. Wonderful. Hop to it. I don't think that was the case with this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it really made it difficult to understand what Corey's intentions were and how Michael fit into all of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I honestly feel, this might be the controversial opinion, I honestly feel this movie would have done better if there was no Michael in it.
Mm.
If you removed Michael Myers from the equation, or the fact that Michael Myers is actually dead, and Corey finds him and is fascinated with him and takes his mask and does the things that he remembers Michael doing, that would change the name of the game.
That would
switch up kind of the focus, if you will. But unfortunately, that's not the case. And that's kind of why I asked the question at the beginning of the show about what your thoughts are about the idea of the boogeyman or the shape, because in this movie, it hints at the idea that Michael is fueled and breathed life into when he does evil, when he kills. Because we see him, there's a scene where we see Corey lead this really obnoxious officer, or whatever he is, yeah, he's an officer, into Michael's quote-unquote den, and lures him in there just so that he could see Michael take him out. And Michael is decrepit, he is old, he is, you know, wobbly, he is walking with a limp, he can barely pick up a knife, and he goes and he stabs this guy, and he stabs him repeatedly, and then you get the sense that he's getting a little bit more rigor out of his hand, and then he just starts stabbing the heck out of this guy after he's long dead, and then Michael stands up straight and tall, and it's almost like he's gotten a whole new sense on life. And I think that's alluding to the idea that Michael is maybe out of lack of opportunity to kill other people. I don't know. The old man that lives near that, the old homeless man that lives near there, obviously knows that when people are taken in there, they don't come back out. So it sounds like he's done it a couple times.
Well, and it's also hinted at, like, there's a big billboard that says missing, and it's got somebody's information on it. It says like October 5th that you see like in passing, but then the only other time that you hear that people are missing is like in passing conversation, either at like the bar or something, and there's a big thing, and it's like five people have gone missing in the last like year. And so you're like, okay, so we can assume that Michael is taking these people to continue to feed his immortality or something. Like, it's his Like,
yeah.
Which is also super crazy because the town's doing nothing about it. It's just blaming Lori.
Well, and that's the thing, that they're blaming Lori and then they're also blaming Corey because I think it's his mom who ends up saying that when it's something along the lines of like, when you lost your boogeyman, they needed to find a new one and it was my son. Like, it's this whole shift from, oh, we could blame, we've been blaming Lori, blaming the Strodes, blah, blah, blah. And it set the entire town on edge. And then they're like, oh, this guy killed him. So he must be the new Mike Myers. Like,
or just the new,
he's the new terror.
Yeah, the new terror, the new boogeyman, the new shape, if you will.
Which is crazy. Killing one person is not equivalent to killing five.
I mean, but let's be honest. I mean, how often do... how many people have you killed, Spence?
Zero.
Okay, just...
I'm killing pizza.
The way you said that, the way you were like, we just killed one person. I mean, that's like kiddie play. I think
Spencer does hit the nail on the head in that regard because he is... one person where they're still living in that Michael Myers frenzy of the town, the lock your doors, close your blinds, like stay inside type of thing, where the boogeyman is still essentially omnipresent because it's only been, what, maybe a year?
I think it's a year
at that point. And then the kid dies. And so it turns into this whole thing where I always think about this line from, and I cannot remember which Shakespeare play it's from, but it's, some people are born great and others have greatness thrust upon them. And Wicked takes a play on this and says, are people born wicked or do they have wickedness thrust upon them? And so when it comes to Corey, where we first meet him at the very beginning of the movie, because surprise, it's where we meet him, he is like all mild-mannered, like scaredy cat. He's just trying to have be a good babysitter. And the little kid is like, Michael Myers just murders the babysitters and never the kids. And he's like, we don't need to talk about that, man. Like, let's like chill out. And you see it progress slowly that he has been so ostracized, and not only with his mother specifically, but the town as a whole has basically taken him and said, you are the bad guy. You are a monster. You are a villain. You know, that's it. And they've forced... as much as Lori points out that there's darkness and evil inside of everybody that's giving in, that creates or lets the door, like opens the door to evil, big evil. I don't know if we're little evil, big evil kind of concept at this point. But when she's saying that, it's a breaking point for Corey where he's tried everything. He's met Allison. He's thinking, okay, maybe this can kind of work out. I don't understand, but he's willing and he's taking those steps, and he runs into the kid's mom in the bar who literally flips out on him. Then he's being bullied by kids in band. Like, come on.
Hold on. Let's talk about that for a second. That first situation where these kids, like Amy said, they're band kids.
One of them is twirling a drumstick like a...
are literally bullying this, he was 21 at the time.
He was 18 when the kid died. So
I thought he was 21. He was getting ready to go. Was getting ready to put applications in for college. So yeah. So he's 21 by that point. So it just... that whole situation of like these ruthless band children...
the band kids are the meanest.
Who apparently have like
pack mentality.
Serious, strong, like New York vibes.
They're Jerseys.
Like, what do you mean you can't help us? What do you mean? No, thank you. What's this? What? It's like, okay, take it easy there, Potsy. Like, dial it back because you're literally smaller than the ice machine that's behind you.
Very true.
But that whole situation was very interesting. But it lent itself to a good opportunity to see Lori come in. But even then, the lack of like recognition, and maybe that speaks more towards like this generation versus the previous generation. I don't know about like just the lack of respect of like, this woman literally has quote unquote killed Michael Myers several times and has seen people die left and right. These kids probably still wet the bed. You know, they have no idea what this woman has been through.
But that also speaks to the
by the way, the Shakespeare you talk, the piece, Twelfth Night.
Thank you. Yeah. And Wicked.
The musical.
Yes. The musical. Yeah. It's also in the book. Anyway, so with regards to this, I think it speaks almost to the generation. Like in Halloween Kills, we see that it's the community, that's the fervor, the craze, it's the stirring up.
It's the manic vibe of the riot.
It's the manic like mob mentality of looking for a hunter in your or a killer in your midst when you cannot find one, so you point at everybody.
You're looking for a killer, so you become a killer, so to speak.
Essentially, yeah. And then in this, at this point, everybody has flipped the script and are like, "Well, she's crazy, and she was the person in the wrong," and they're making excuses instead of going, "She's a survivor." Also, this is flipping Haddonfield. These children, like, literally grew up with these stories, so they would know Laurie Strode even in her sunshine and rainbows phase. And it is like, it's legitimately it's really disheartening.
It's disjointed writing, because you have a character who definitively deserves to have the revere and recognition of if not everybody, the older townsfolk, for what she has done, but also to the mindset of the recognition of loss that Laurie has because of what she's gone through. This woman has lost her daughter, her son-in-law, friends. She has lost loved ones to Michael Myers, and she is still here. You know, that whole survivor's guilt is a real thing. So it's interesting, you know, in terms of, like, you look at that and you reflect back on the other movies, like we said, where Laurie has resolve, she has purpose. It may have been birthed in that first film when she stabs him in the neck with a knitting needle. Like, we have the solidification of our scream queen, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it carries in those previous two films. And then she's extremely just at a docile point for this one, for the good part of the film, in fear of losing that domesticated situation that she's in. Hmm. You know, because to be honest, the film goes into some psychological levels of like, well, you're just this and that, or you're just, you know, wanting to keep everybody from whatever, living their life, or it throws out a lot of information based on their thoughts about Laurie, because it seems like everybody has like a whole psychological case file on Laurie. Everybody has like
the town DJ. Like,
oh, see, I feel like what really happened in the background is like this nonsense DJ that's just broadcasting this nonsense. I feel like he's like the Alex Jones of the town, and he's putting out like all this nonsense, and then everyone's just gobbling it up.
Yeah, because I feel like the only death that was actually deserved was that DJ. Like, I felt like that DJ deserved it.
I mean, I wasn't too like sad about the doctor and his sugar baby, like, getting the axe. I was just like, I could appreciate the callback to the way that, like, this is, so at this point, because Michael has reawakened, like, Corey has reawakened Michael, and he goes out, and it's like father son like job trip, guys. we're gonna go murder folk,
and take your kid to work day.
It is, because at this point Corey has a mask on, but it's kind of disturbing in a great way as an identity, which I was like, okay, because it's,
which, mind you,
which was actually, I was like, okay, the way this is staged and sequenced, that is creepy and a really good idea.
Which, mind you, could be a nod to Wicked in itself, because it is a scarecrow mask. Yeah. Mm. You know, if you think about it. I was thinking about it while you had mentioned it. I was like, oh, that could be a nod to Wicked in that way, because of that that saying.
But, well, and also I was thinking, because of the way it's the Halloween mask that essentially Corey was wearing the night that he first meets Michael. And so him maintaining and taking this mask with him and choosing, it's like, this is what has made me, blah, blah, blah. It seemed fitting, and it was also disturbing enough. Like, I was like, oh, this is uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But the way that the sugar baby, Allison's work friend who got a promotion because she's boning the boss, how Michael literally kills her, like, that, it was I was like, oh, this is a really...
It's a callback.
But I was like, for me, I'm like, oh, this isn't as scary. And I was like, yeah, you, I kind of feel you deserve it. I don't mean to be that person, but I was like, it's like, it's not fully necessary, but it was literally like a take your son to work day moment. Mm-hmm. And I was trying not to laugh.
Well, it was, you could have called it from as soon as she got that promotion and she talks about it like, okay, I get it. You're sleeping with the doctor. I get it. We know you're going to die now. Because like every time she opened her mouth, like, because before she seemed a little bit more friendly, she seemed a little bit more like welcoming to an extent, like when she would talk with Allison, talk about the party, she was at the party, blah, blah, blah. And then the transition happens where I guess just evil befalls everyone who's already evil. And she's like, oh yeah, I guess, you know, it was a surprise to me too. I got the promotion, blah, blah, blah. And this and that going off and then laughing and giggling with the doctor. And I was like, okay, we get it. So the inevitable demise of those two was going to happen. It's just a matter of how. And I do appreciate the callback to him literally picking her up by the neck, holding her against the wall, and then stabbing her, sticking her to the wall. Mm-hmm. That was very much a callback to the first film.
The very first film, yeah.
But
I think this is where we kind of run into some of my issues with not the direction of the story, but the way that this story has decided to
unfold.
Yeah. And it's taking where this new trilogy has been about exploring multi-generation trauma and the multi-generational impact it has. There we go. That word out there. And this is simultaneously averts it and diverts it because we're seeing that Allison has not taken the time for somebody who's processed and in therapy and has dealt with trauma and continues to work through trauma for healing. You can see when people are not healing for the sake of the people around them.
Yeah.
Or they're choosing not to heal because it's inconvenient. And you see it with Allison. You see it constantly with Allison. And then when you see it where Lori is doing everything in her power to show everything's okay, Allison. I'm okay, Allison. It's okay, Allison. And they don't honor that Lori. There is no way in come heck or high heaven that Lori is still 100% peachy keen.
Like, no, of course not.
Like the entire thing where we see her, they cover up, they blanket her in the snow of I'm all better and I forgive everybody. Blah 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 blah. And when we finally catch glimpses of the Lori that's still in there, it's as quickly swept under the rug as possible. And so it robs her of the opportunity to show what somebody who is continually working through healing and who, even though their trauma, they are no longer living in those spaces of extreme survivalism, that their trauma is still there, but it's eating away at them less and less, and they're able to start letting go. And Allison in the reverse is she's not dealt with her grief. She's not dealt with the trauma. And then she's like, this guy gets me. And I was like, no, we don't need this trope. Don't do it. Stop.
Yep.
And they didn't.
And it's hard to really see any kind of resolve for this story in a full direction, because that's what we're used to. We're used to seeing a direction for these particular type of story archetypes, these characters, and there's a focus that they're doing. There's a drive, and it just seemed like it was kind of set on something, and then, like Amy said, it diverted from healing holistically. Because whatever Lori was doing, she was trying to find her peace through writing it. But yes, Allison was probably not doing anything or not ready to do anything. And then thrusting this whole situation into a place where people who are obviously not ready to go in that direction of life, be put into that direction of life and expected for them to just perform. You know, it's a lot like, in that aspect, it is a lot like real life, where people who deal with trauma or deal with situations or deal with just life in general are hit with something so hard that it knocks them on their butt and they realize that they're not okay. And instead of trying to find help, they go about it by doing other things or just staying busy, which is the worst thing to do. And then they stay busy and then something happens that is almost slightly parallel or mirrors the current situations that cause them trauma and they jump right back in head first, you know, because obviously it's kind of apparent that Allison is just to an extent willing to be self-destructive. Mm-hmm. You know, she takes this guy she just met, whom she comes on way too strong to, like, she's essentially to you know, go around all the bases as soon as she meets the guy. Because she's like, you know, you have a motorcycle.
We're not slut-shaming. We just need to establish the fact that this is where you can tell the difference when someone is being self-destructive for the sake of being self-destructive. And the words that she continues to use later on in, he's the first person that made me feel something. Like, no.
Mm-mm. Yeah. And it creates this spiraling of emotional trauma that is masked with, you know, moments and brief seconds of satisfaction and feel goods, you know, to keep this rosy eyed, you know, look of hers to just like give into it as much as she can and do the things that she does and give into the things that he says. Like he says a lot of very destructive things like, you know, let's burn the town down. Let's do this. Let's do
I'll
that.
I'll light the match. You know? There were parallels I can say for Heather's, Christian Slater's character in Heather's, where he was talking about bringing down the Heathers and destroying the school and murdering everybody. The tone that Corey sets when he's finally, I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid of mortality. Like when he's going on that speech and you're just like, uh-oh, he's unhinged. And she's like, tell me more.
And mind you, the good thing that this film does is everybody else is aware of it. Mm-hmm. Everybody who is close to the situation. I thought it was a great moment when Lori is visiting with, what is her name? The little girl that was in the first film, who's now the bartender.
Just the bartender.
Well, that's actually the Lindsay, Kyle Richards' character from the first film. Lindsay, who manages the bar or is just a bartender, tells him, you know, you need to go talk to this person. And it happens to be the father of the kid that Corey had killed. And they have this whole conversation where he's been processing and he's been trying to figure out and he's been trying to make ways to get past it. And even to the attempt of seeing Corey on the side of the road and willing to go over and essentially create this connection that was lost due to the loss of their life, of their son's life. And what he says is, you know, before I knew he wouldn't have hurt a fly, this, this, and that. And now that kid is gone. And he's recognizing it by the way, by the look and by the feel and just the intentionality behind the eyes of that kid, of Corey, and recognizing like this is not okay. He is not okay. Not to the extent of like, oh, he is pure evil now and he needs this and that, but that he's in a space where he needs help. Mm-hmm. He is in a place where he needs to talk to someone or he needs to get professional help because someone at his age who is ostracized and demonized in a town that shows no love to him will have issues in the long run. And he even says that earlier in the film. He goes, don't let people like that talk to you. Even if you don't know it, it's going to make you feel sad. And it's like, that's somebody who's crying for help, someone who knows what that looks like. And everybody else got it except for the rosy-eyed glasses Allison and the uncertain, shaky ground of Lori, because Lori doesn't want to hurt her granddaughter and her granddaughter's love life, and Allison doesn't see anything wrong with what Corey is doing, or that she's aware of.
Well, we also need to point out that Lori is the reason that Allison meets Corey, because their initial like meetup is, Lori finds Corey outside of the gas station being beaten up
by band members.
By the band members. By the marching band. And he gets his
he gets a piece of glass stuck in his piece pond.
From a chocolate milk bottle, which made me so sad. The boy is still drinking his chocolate milk.
That's another thing. I don't know if it was intentional, but the mentality of showing that he wasn't worthy, where he goes from regular, like, real chocolate milk in that first few scenes, and then he's now relegated to just chocolate drink. It kind of seems like a step down, but it's like, it's the best of what I can do kind of thing. Like, that intentionality to show that kind of seemed like there's been a lot of pushing down, a lot of, like, really showing he wasn't worthy to still be around in this town. He wasn't worthy to still be alive, even though he was found not guilty. So,
yeah. And then Lori ends up taking him to the hospital to Allison. And she, like, when Allison's like, I know what you're doing. And she's like, he's hurt. He just needed somebody. And she's like playing matchmaker. But simultaneously, also, I think she still believes that because he has trauma and she has trauma, they're able to have that shared, like, the shared experience of trying to grow together, which I feel bad and I feel good about Lori trying to do this, because she's seeing people that really, like, when you create a community of people who have had trauma or shared trauma and you commit to growing and to healing, whether it's side by side, but you're, like, working towards the goal of healing to be better for each, like, yourselves, it's a good thing. But the thing is that Lori, who is Sunshine Rainbow's Lori, is not being as realistic as she knows she should be. Like, it's so many questions about trauma, so many questions about how this has been impacting the Strode woman for years, and the abrupt pivots, the changes. Oh, somebody take the mic. Somebody help. Spencer, help.
Spencer, what are your thoughts?
Like, this is kind of a lot. Yeah. like there's way too much going on with, like, just, like, people's trauma backstories and, like, people becoming trauma buddies, but should they? Like, I don't know if this is even, like, I was watching this and I'm like, I don't even know why we're going down this route for the movie.
Yeah,
exactly. Because, like, once that first kid died, I was like, well, that's the end we'll see of Corey. Mm. Like, I didn't expect him to be the main character of this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the problem is, like I said, if this movie didn't have Michael Myers in it and Corey just, the idea, the illusion is that people get to a space where evil is the only choice, and that is what makes up entities like Michael Myers, and that is what makes up the entity of, you know, who Corey is becoming. That would make sense. But then you had to create a, you know, Abbott and Costello kind of thing, where you had Michael Myers as the straight man and Corey as, you know, the pudgy, shorter guy, you know, doing the things that he does. It confuses the audience in terms of recognizing, what are you doing to make me feel like I want to see how this ends? Because the only thing that really drew a lot of people in for the ending of this one is that it was going to be the last one. It's going to be the final time we see Michael Myers. It was going to be the ending of the saga. It was going to be the ending of the franchise. And the thing is, we all know here at this table, this more than likely 99.999999% sure, this is not going to be the last film. And we all know that there's going to be another iteration. And we all know that something is going to happen where, if not Michael Myers continues in this saga, some sense of him or his spirit.
It's going to be Corey again.
Yeah, they're going to Ouija board. Well, remember, Corey's dead, quote unquote. But someone's going to Ouija board Mike, and they're going to be like, Michael Myers, please come visit us here today. It's going to be something dumb. One of them's going to get quote unquote possessed, and then we're just going to have, like, no, It's either that, and people, let's be honest, these companies love a good money making franchise.
True. And yeah, I mean, we get to the ending of the film, and I don't mind spoiling it because obviously everybody else is going to talk about it, but you get this interesting kind of back and forth between Michael Myers and Laurie, where Laurie gets him into a very, you know, vulnerable position of like stabbing both of his arms down on the table, knocking a fridge over to pin his legs, and
cutting his neck
and
stabbing him more.
And he's able to get a hand free and gets a hold of her neck, which at this time, his hand looks like something from Terminator 2, where the T-1000's hand is just all split. Like, his hand looks like it's an open banana, but it still has the grip strength of a demon because it's grabbing hold of Laurie, and Laurie's like, just do it, you know, thinking that it just, both of their stories need to end here. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it doesn't, and Laurie makes sure that, you know, he bleeds out fully, but they also need to make sure he just doesn't come back. So they do this whole town processional where they attach the body of Michael Myers to the top of
A 2000 and something Ford Focus.
I don't even know if it was that new.
Was a 2000 something. Trust me, I had one.
On top of Allison's car, and they drive it all the way to the junkyard where Corey worked, and they put his body into this meat shredder kind of, or this metal shredder type thing, which that thing that you see on all the YouTube videos where people are throwing fruit and toys and, you know, Stretch Armstrongs into to see how it, you know, gets crushed up into a million pieces, and you throw his body in there and it gets crushed, and we get this kind of epilogue of where Allison decides to finally move on with her life. She leaves the town. Laurie is finishing her memoirs and gets a little cozy to Officer Frank, and they may have a relationship, and that the evil may be gone, but the shape never, whatever. It kind of ends in a very ambiguous way. We're like, okay, does everybody go back to the way it was, or, you know, is what's happening now kind of thing? Which is fine, because I think the less we know, the more we need to have resolved for us in a follow-up film.
It's coming.
No. Which is coming.
I want to point out something that was really uncomfortable and irksome for me, and I also understood it. So before, of course, he officially exsanguinates and Michael is dead, she is holding this man's hand, like, in this, and they took long enough to pause for a beat and a half on her holding his hand. And it's in this space of, once we've dealt with, now Corey is officially dead, because if he can't have Allison, nobody can. Kudos, Corey, you freak. Like, not in the great way, but just like, no, bye. They're holding hands, and it's this, it had this weird air and tension around it where it's almost, they tried to romanticize it. It was the thing, because it followed so closely with Corey's at this point, right before Michael Myers and Laurie have their final standoff, which was actually really good because it showed their age, mm-hmm. like that they're continuing to fight, and you see both of them are tired and both of them are like worn out, and you can feel it in the way they fight. It still turned out nice. But before that, you have Corey has decided he's coming to kill Laurie after he's stolen Michael Myers' mask, and he's doing it because he wants Allison, and Allison won't leave unless Grandma is dead. And so he literally, at this point, Laurie gets to the house, they have a bit of a fight, and then Corey decides to stab himself at the neck. Allison comes home because they were supposed to meet up. Allison sees Corey on the floor bleeding out. Grandma's holding the knife because she pulled it out, and she's freaking out that the guy killed himself. And Allison's like, oh my God! Like, she's like, the man I ever loved! And then she runs out. And so when we get to the moment where Laurie and Michael have had their final thing, Laurie has basically, like, she's done. Allison's come to save the day and unchoke her. And they have that lingered moment. I was like, this was too close for me. This was too close in connection to that the only man I've ever loved. I love him even though he was a monster thing. Was too close to the goodbye, I finally killed my monster vibe. And
I don't see it. I don't feel like it was like that for me. There was no romanticism to it. It felt more of like, this is Laurie recognizing that at the end of it all, Michael Myers was just a man, and this man is literally dying in his last moments on this table. And it's almost like a warrior honors another warrior kind of thing for me. Definitely not in the same caliber of how well it was done, but it reminds me a bit of that episode in Star Wars Rebels where Obi-Wan Kenobi and Darth Maul finally come to meet, and they finally have the battle that's been building up for ages and ages, and we have this beautiful episode. Just quick, not even it's in the flick of an eye that it happens, and Maul is down and he is dying in the arms of Obi-Wan, and Obi-Wan is holding him, and it isn't because Obi-Wan loves him, but Obi-Wan recognizes this man has been driven by the thing that has been fueling his hate and his fear and his desire to just see destroyed. And Obi-Wan has lived his life as a soldier, as someone who has been, you know, betrayed by the Jedi Order and is the last remaining, just like Maul. And in this moment, he sees Maul is another warrior just like him who was put through the system. And this is what has become of them. And I think in this situation, you take two people who have been fighting for ages, for decades, and in a slight, most minuscule moment, it was Laurie saying, okay, I know you're dying. I'm here. I'll be here for your last breath kind of thing. I didn't see it as a romanticization because I really didn't want to think anything more of Corey. But like I felt like it lent itself more to the idea that this has been a battle that is finally going to end. And at the end of it, the two soldiers who have been the main odds at ends are seeing this fight complete, you know, and it seemed more like that to me. Now, mind you, I may be giving more credit to the director and to the filmmakers, but I feel like with everything that we've seen, that's what I want it to be, because I feel like this scene, this movie, this franchise has given us so much in terms of seeing people grow and be churned out by the fear and by the evil and being driven to do things or be a certain way because of that evil, and this evil just running the lives of both of these people, and finally having, if you want to call it this, that piece of death, you know? So,
well, my interpretation of the scene, since we're going around the table for this,
sure,
was at first, like, I was also like, they're not trying to,
right?
Because, like, for a brief second, I was like, oh, and then, like, I was like, no, no, but then I was like, well, what are they trying to say? And that's where I was settling on, like, I think where I'm settling on this is just she was holding his hand just to wait for that moment when he died. Because, like, she wanted to feel that slack. That's, like, the best I could get
come that's up not with. A bad idea, actually. Like, yeah. And I think that's the thing that the sequential sequence after where they parade his body through the town, where I was like, there's no blood on this car. We need to fix that. But it was the with Allison and Laurie driving the car and the entire town and the police escort and everybody seeing, it was the look, here is the monster, or here is the dragon. I have slain the dragon, and it will no longer be a burden or a tax upon our town, the proof of it. And initially I was like, and when they got to the junkyard and everybody's touching the body and carrying it off the car, I was like, ooh, I don't know how I feel about this. And then I realized that it was Laurie's way, and I think it's actually the story, the writer's way, of saying, this is what I'm trying to show. The town needed to be healed. The town needed to have proof. Laurie needed to, for her own kind of sanity, to say, I'm not crazy. Look at me and notice. and then for them to essentially kill the boogeyman together to try to put it to rest.
See their own boogeyman and feel the tangibleness of this entity that has been, you know, terrorizing their town for over 50 years and be able to say it is done and to say, okay, my boogeyman, the town's boogeyman, is now gone.
Yeah, you know? the term when she's reading back for her memoir, the voiceover for the memoir, where it's, there was a midnight mass processional, there is no tombstone and there is no like monument. I was like, okay, so we pulled that straight out of whatever was written, but it carried, like, for me, and I had to sit and think on it because I was having a really rough time with not the fact that they killed him, not the fact that they, like, strapped his body to the roof and they drove him through the town, blah, blah. I was like, it felt almost like a little bit initially for me of, like, a hero worship.
See, I got that same vibe from when
like, right,
carrying
yeah.
his body.
Oh. Yeah, carrying his body, and then that everybody was lining the streets and watching. And then I realized that it was something more primal and something more Dark Ages, like, essentially, or even what the Romans did when they would come back with the conquests from wherever they were, and they'd be like, here is our parade, and here is our slaves, and here are the people that we've murdered. And I was like, the town needed something primal to believe in so that they could essentially, hopefully, let go of that shared, like, community trauma. But yeah, initially I was like, it feels like hero worship so much, and I did not like it.
So wrapping this whole thing up, let's go ahead and go around the table. And I did have a roundtable question for y'all. And it is, so how do you feel about a franchise continuing after its quote-unquote expiration date? And do you feel this film has hit that point?
Spencer.
I feel like it really depends on if a studio can even like suss out when like the expiration date for a thing is.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes like... you'll put out a bad, like, oh, let's actually take Jurassic World. The first one, like, I liked that one. It was okay. The second one, I forget what that one was, Dominion or something like that. That one, I was like, we're done here. We don't need another
one. Don't need more, no.
And then when they was like, we're bringing back the original cast, I was like, I don't know if you can pull it off, but I'm willing to see it for Dr. Grant and Dr. Sattler.
Yeah, okay. I agree on that.
And so, like, I think it really depends on, like, you know, the franchise, where it's at, and where you think it's going.
Mm.
Because, like, if, like, that last Jurassic World movie hadn't had the original cast, I'd be like, this is a waste of time.
I can agree with that wholeheartedly.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I think that when a town, I said when a town hits their expiration date, sorry, Haddonfield. When a franchise finally hits that space, it is the responsibility of people who actually and actively care about that franchise to say goodbye in a way that is meaningful but closes the book for good. And when you have people who only care about the money that's coming in, you end up with things that keep going and going and going, and as fast and as furious as they keep going,
oh my gosh,
they just don't understand that they should probably stop. So I am not for people beating a franchise to death where it destroys the integrity of the stories that it tells.
I agree to a point. I feel like we have certain franchises, certain franchises that may have been great and done well, like for instance, if they decided to redo the first Tron film, that would be interesting with the technology at hand. The original is still great. It's iconic, but done in a more updated version, not like Legacy, would be interesting. Is the continuation of that film something that the world needs? Definitely not. We don't need any more, you know, CGI Jeff Bridges. It's fine in where it's at and where it lies. Recreating the first film and doing something unique, that would be interesting. And I'm sure there's a bunch of other ones that would be cool to see redone or given new life, much like Michael Myers and his stabbing. In terms of this particular franchise, I do feel that it's hit that precipice to where it's on that mountaintop and it's cresting over. And that's what this movie did. It's cresting over the greatness of what the last two films had done in terms of giving fans a true-to-form sequel to that first iconic movie. Now, anything else after the fact is going to just go downhill really fast. But I don't feel that this movie has hit its expiration date. I don't feel like the essence of this movie is done. I feel like the legacy, kind of like what Amy put in, I really like the way she said it, which is why I asked her to say it, the Strode saga. I am glad that this is the last for Jamie Lee Curtis. She's a great actress and she's doing other wonderful projects. However, I feel like within the essence of what we saw out of this film, continuing the idea of the evil of Michael, or even just the idea of evil being something other than Michael Myers, might be something worth exploring. I'm open to that. Done with the right director, the right screenwriter, I don't feel the franchise has hit an expiration point, but I feel like beating a dead horse, i.e. the dynamic between Laurie Strode and Michael Myers, has hit its expiration point. You know, coming back from this, it's going to be a real funny one to see if they try to make a sequel and he comes back somehow. Like, his hand is still alive and he sews himself back up together. Like, I don't know.
All movies after this point are just season of the witch escorts.
Exactly. Exactly.
But, like, I think, just to wrap up this part of the conversation, there is one franchise that kind of unexpired themselves to me.
What's that?
And that's the Predator one. Because before this last one, I was like, why would you even bother making another movie? Yeah. Because the one before this was so ridiculous. I was like, no. But then they released that last one that we reviewed earlier last month, I believe.
Yeah.
Or the month before.
And with Prey. Yeah.
Yeah. In Prey August, was fantastic. And we wouldn't miss that on that. So, like, I feel like it really depends. Like, you really need to, like, not be a cash grab is really what I think it comes down to.
No, absolutely. And in that same vein, I feel like creating another, in that same mindset, like creating another Aliens movie with a new fresh mindset that doesn't have to bring Sigourney Weaver into the fray and beat that character into another, you know, level of like, oh my God, are you serious? But carrying the heart of that might also, that might be something we may see, because the last prequel, which was Covenant, wasn't bad. Prometheus was a little interesting, but Covenant wasn't bad. And I wouldn't mind seeing the continuation of that story. Plus, we get a great character with Michael Fassbender, and the way that movie ended leaves you on a cliffhanger. And you're like, what the heck, man? Like, so, yeah, I feel like there are several of those kinds of franchises. And this one, I feel, needs, much like a Michael Myers stabbing, new life breathed into it and given an opportunity to explore other options. So with that said, let's go ahead and go around the table. Does the film pass or fail? And how many monocles? I want to start with Amy.
Okay.
The bringer of no coffee. Go ahead.
Ay, Gavalt. Okay. So does this movie have a story? Does it have a beginning, middle, and an end? It does. So, squeaky teeth, it passes as that point. Monocles, you're not getting much out of me. I love you, Jamie Lee Curtis. You are an amazing actress. You breathed life into a character that I did not know, one that I would appreciate as much as I have, and that, as begrudgingly as I'm saying this, finally being at peace with yourself and giving yourself that space to say goodbye to Lori was something that the world needed, even though we did not expect it. With that being said, Michael, you're dead. Stay dead. Don't do anything else. Leave the Strodes alone. If you want to make mention of them, you've got clipping, newspaper clippings, yada, yada. This was not the scariest of the three that I saw. And that makes me kind of laugh. So, unfortunately, you're getting a 1.25 monocles.
Wow.
Because I would watch, and this is going to say a lot, I would watch Halloween 2018 again and be more scared than this movie. And that's for me saying I'm willing to watch Halloween 2018 mm-hmm. again to see that, Lori. Oh, Spencer.
Yeah, I'll agree. This movie passes, despite the fact I think it should be two different movies in different setups, but whatever. But yeah, this it makes me sad, man. Like, I came in expecting, like, you know, just like Lori getting ready for like a final confrontation with Michael, and I got a love story between like Lori's granddaughter and like a nice guy turned psychotic murderer, which was sad, but like also whatever, I guess. Yeah, the story was just kind of like not where I was expecting it to be, like coming into like the final for Lori. Like, it's like just Lori and Michael were part of someone else's movie, which just seems super odd to me. So yeah, I'll give it 2. Because Jamie Lee Curtis is amazing, and I still liked that Michael was in his own movie, I guess. Mm-hmm. But like, it just wasn't there for me.
Yeah. In terms of the story, in terms of passing or failing, I'll pass it for the simple fact that we do get resolution for Lori as an individual, maybe not for her whole family, but for her as a person, as an actress, as a character, letting go and getting a chance to just be a normal person, which she hasn't been able to for the last 40 years of her life, 40, 50 years. So I do give it that. I do give credit to where credit is due with the writers and what they were trying to do. Us being very smart film critics, we saw a lot of that, but we also recognize the main audiences won't get that. And they'll just see kills and deaths and Lori being Lori. Or Lori not being Lori. So in terms of monocles, now, here's the thing. I feel like as a critic, and Amy kind of was hinting towards it, as a critic, we have to look at the entire franchise as a whole to really see where it fits within the bill. And unfortunately, this wasn't the strongest out of this new chronological order. However, I do give Jamie Lee Curtis all the kudos in the world for doing what she's done and creating a character whom we all still follow 40 plus years, you know, for this entire time. And I will give it a 2.5, mostly in the vein of as long as they don't make a second follow-up. If they do, it drops to a 1.
But, yeah, there you go.
But yeah, so that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Filmlosophers. Remember, you can check us out on our website at filmlosophers.com. There you can check out all of our episodes. We have over 300, allegedly, everything ranging from romance to comedy to action to conversations about the industry. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head over to our website, filmlosophers.com. You can also find us on any podcast streaming app, whether if it's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, iHeart, TuneIn. You can tune in to wherever your heart's desire and listen to us. Give us a follow. Give us a subscribe. Listen in. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know in the comments down below, and give us a 5-star review. We've earned it. Also, you can check us out on the socials at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101. There we post as often as we can. You'll find Spencer's big score excerpts there, which Spencer will be doing starting next month, and Amy's Jane on Scene, which, where can you find that at, Miss Amy?
The only place it's ever lived, on Instagram at Jane on Scene.
There you go. This was a great episode, and mind you, this is a Halloween tradition and a birthday tradition that we have continued to carry, However, we will be looking for new opportunities come next year, and we want to hear your thoughts. We want to hear your input. Let us know on our Instagram page or our Facebook page or on any of our podcast apps, wherever you follow us. Let us know if you have a great franchise that is delved in horror and Halloween at the same time. Let us know. Let's get Amy scared. Well, we're gonna make that a hashtag. Let's get Amy scared. So, but like I said, that wraps up another great, awesome episode with these guys. And so we thank you for listening in. We hope to hear from you next week. And from all of us here at the Filmosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm Final Girl Amy.
Class dismissed.